Now, did y'all see what I just did? If you're not familiar with this process, it's called a stack. The reason that we do this is because, have you ever been someplace where somebody gives a speech and, you know, they give a great speech? Hell, maybe I gave a bad speech, but I spoke, right? We'll all agree that I spoke. And then the speaker says, okay, comments or questions, and a bunch of hands go up, and then there's some back and forth with one person, and then the speaker says, next, and all these hands go up, and the speaker goes back and forth. You can almost feel the tension rising in the room, right? The reason I did that, numbers 2 through 8, relax. You're going to get to ask your question or make your comment. See, as an organizer, I want to share that little trick with you, because that little trick shows that we know how to share space together. What we really need to do is actually start to practice democracy together. So now, numbers 2 through 8, not only can you relax, but please do like I'm going to do, and actually give your full attention to number 1. Who is number 1?
Oh, I think it was me.
Yes.
Yeah. As a lawyer, originally, we used to be able to revoke charters, and that didn't seem to work very well, because most corporations aren't even chartered in our state. And it seemed like a critical step happened when corporations were allowed to operate in every state, if they no matter which state chartered them.
Okay, so the question is, hey, well, corporate charters used to be able to be used, but now corporations are not chartered in all the states. But here, that's true, and I want to point this out. Even today, in order to do business in any state, a corporation must obtain what is legally called a certificate of authority to do business. So the reality is, corporate charter revocation proceedings could be enacted today if there was the political will. You could revoke the certificate of authority to do business in Massachusetts today if there was the political will. See, the problem is not that these mechanics don't exist anymore. All of those things that I described originally, limiting their duration, you could limit their size with a charter, you could say what they could or couldn't do, you could revoke their charter or their authority to do business, if there was simply the political will to demand it. Let me tell you something. You know, another great American said something I think that's important. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. Frederick Douglass said that. It was true then, it's true now. Here's something else he said. You show me the exact amount of injustice that a people will be willing to tolerate, and I will show you exactly, precisely, the amount of injustice that will be delivered upon them. So here's the thing, Ethan. The problem is not that we don't have tools. The problem is that we don't have the political will to force those tools to be used.
You mean we're not nailed by the Commerce Clause?
No, we are not nailed by the Commerce Clause. In fact, this idea of the Commerce Clause being the real problem is, I think, it fails to understand this. There's also another clause in the U.S. Constitution called the General Welfare Clause. And you actually go to the U.S. Constitution, I could point to you language that basically says Congress has the authority to do all of the things that they need to do in order not the preamble, actually Article 1 has a General Welfare Clause. The problem has been that both lawyers and judges and as a society, we have actually expressed and understood the Constitution to just be a property rights document. So I'll tell you something. I don't think that, let me be very clear. As a lawyer, the problem is not a legal one. Like, it's not just that we need a really smart lawyer to come up and make an argument. A good way to point this out is, you know, why is Thurgood Marshall famous? Say it again. First African-American on the Supreme Court, and as a lawyer, I would tell you, he's most famous as the lawyer who argued Brown versus Board of Education. Now, let me ask you this question. Did Thurgood Marshall think of a legal argument that nobody had thought of before him? No. See, I tell you this. Thurgood Marshall was able to be the winning lawyer in Brown versus Board of Education, not because he was a brilliant legal scholar, which he was, by the way. I want to be clear. That's not why he won Brown versus Board of Education. And it's not because those 9 white racists, saw the light. I think it's because there had been 40, 50 years of organizing by the Anti-Lynching League and the NAACP, and in churches and in synagogues and in faith communities, right? This is the bottom line, Ethan. Political movements have got to shift the culture. Because as a lawyer, I'll tell you, law follows culture. If we actually had a new political culture, if we had another political will, there are the tools right now to recreate our society and rein in these instruments known as corporations. And yes, corporate charter revocation should be one of them. Who's number two? Yes, sir.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thanks for coming, y'all.
The challenge that I'm feeling is you're asking, in terms of moving to amend, to support a campaign which is, I can't think of anything more difficult to do. You know, it's like in terms of you saying, elect Green Party and other progressives to take over the presidency, the Congress to appoint good people to the Supreme Court. That seems like very, very ambitious. To amend the Constitution means 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the state legislature. So I'm comfortable with the vision of the political strategy.
Okay, fair enough. And I would say, first and foremost, I want to thank you for actually pointing out how difficult and what it will be. And the reason I thank you for that is because I want to be very clear to you and everybody else in here. I intend to win. I intend for this to happen in my lifetime. And I am not joking. Here's the thing. The problem, I think I've described the problem accurately. I think that I have described what a win actually looks like that's worthy of being called a win. And I'll go one step further. As difficult as this task is, and it is a difficult one, it is no more difficult than imagining being able to uproot the depraved institution of slavery upon which the entire social, political, economic, and cultural reality of the United States existed. The problem that I'm describing and the solution that I'm calling for is no more difficult than the audacity of those women in Seneca Falls who thought that they could overturn the entire cultural reality known as patriarchy. It's no different than the civil rights movement or the trade union movement or any other movement that's worth being called a movement. You see, I believe that the world is being destroyed and that a racist, sexist, class oppressive society is being created with the plunder. And I gotta say, I don't think it's time to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. I think it's time for us to say, we need a whole nother boat, quick. Right? We already hit the iceberg. We need actually a whole different thing. And so here's the thing. Yes, it's difficult. Absolutely. I own that it's difficult. And I say, don't we need to actually tell the truth about what we're up against? And here's the last thing. If I'm right that we're like the Titanic and metaphorically we've already hit the iceberg, I'll tell you this. I would like to imagine that I'd be the kind of human being that would conduct myself with some dignity, some compassion with other human beings, and not be the kind of person that runs my sorry ass over women and children and, you know, just to get my own self to a lifeboat, or that I would pretend like it didn't happen. I like to think that my mama raised the kind of person who would actually have some decency. And I think that what we need to do today is to come to terms with how serious the crisis is and to begin the process of slowly and deliberately acting accordingly. So you bet it's a difficult thing. And I say, because it's so hard, shouldn't we get started now?
Yes.
Right? I mean, like, I guess I would say this. Because I'm trying to take your question very seriously.
I'm saying there is an easier, more realistic way of doing it.
Which is?
Electing a president of the United States, and this is hard enough, electing a president of the United States, getting control of Congress, appointing people to the Supreme Court, just overruling the constitutional. I mean, it's like...
Well, what I would say is this.
It's not permanent. And that is... what the Green Party is trying to do, and that is so ambitious as of itself. But to talk about 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the state legislature, it's like 3 times as more difficult.
Well, I guess what I would say is this. I mean, you do know that I ran for president as a Green Party. Okay, just wanted to check. Okay, so it's not as if I say don't do that. Right? I mean, what I'm saying is this. I think that we need to use all the tools in the toolbox. And I think that an ultimate win will actually end up amending the Constitution. Because I'll go this far. The U.S. Constitution is the codification of the social contract. And we need a new social contract in this country. Because it's honestly, I actually think as hard as what I've just described is, actually, how about a U.S. Constitution that will say every human being has an actual constitutional right to enough food to eat, and adequate housing, and a right to health care? What if we dared to, you can applaud that, what if we actually said nature has rights that we will acknowledge? See, I guess what I'm saying is, I actually think that the Green Party approach, as important as it is actually not big enough. I think actually the problem is we need to understand we need an electoral strategy, we need a legal strategy, we need a media strategy, and we need a movement strategy. So we've got to be actually doing all of those things. And honestly, I think it's important to recognize that the move to amend approach is uniting Greens and progressive Democrats and independents and even principled libertarians and conservatives in this movement. You don't have to be willing to join a political party to join move to amend. I think that's an important step.
David, I want to add.
Please, George.
In building the movement, and it absolutely is difficult. It's 6, 8, 12, 20 years. For some people, it's the rest of your life. But if you're building a movement from the grassroots up, helping people build local power that they feel and experience, as you're doing that in 6, 8, 12 to 20 years, you're going to win local elections. You're going to win statewide elections. You may win national elections, but we're not looking at that small win as our goal. We're looking at the whole pie. And if you go for the whole pie, if you're taking on the whole mountain, you're going to take on the small cliffs too. You're going to win those too. But let's head for the top of the mountain and not settle for halfway up. Because halfway up leaves hundreds of thousands, at least, people who are living in poverty, dealing with the results of racism, homophobia, sexism, Islamophobia, leaves them out. I'm not about leaving anybody out. Let's go for all of it, take the wins in the middle, but take all of it, and
George
not
Friar.
Settle for less.
George Friar. George Friar, independent professor, Politics Network, and on the executive committee of Move to Amend. Before I go to number three, you know what? If this were Texas, there wouldn't be a man without a hat on his head. What's wrong with you people? Ma'am, can I borrow your hat? I see a hat here. Can I borrow that hat too? Off of your head?
You see, not only am I a lawyer, I'm also a magician.
And to prove it, these hats are now empty, and I will turn them into. That's right. See, my grandfather's a Baptist preacher.
I'm going to pass the hat. And before I do, I'm going to ask, hey, John, how much did I charge you to come here today?
Zero.
How much? Oh, Jill Stein, how much did I charge the Green Rainbow Party?
Zero.
Barbara, how much did I charge Alliance for Democracy? Nothing. So here's the thing. I'm going to pass this hat, and I'm going to ask y'all, honestly, in the spirit of true free will giving, give whatever it is that you're either inspired to or want to. And I mean this seriously. If you don't want to give any money, don't, and I will not take it personally. I'm totally serious. But I'm going to pass this around, and if you can and you want to, give it. And if you can write a check, the organization that keeps me on the road is called Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, or DUHC. If you want to write a check, but you don't actually have your checkbook with you, you can write down this address and mail it. P.O. Box 610, Eureka, California, and the zip is 95501. So if you would like to actually make a contribution that way, so if you would pass this that way, this down this side, and I think this goes to the end here. I want to make sure everybody gets a chance. And now, who's number three on our stack? Yes, Dave.
No, I don't believe in magic exactly, but there's something magic about 5%. I think 5% can run a revolution. 5%. What I have in mind is this. In Brazil, participatory budgeting was put into effect. It's perhaps the most democratic institution that has arisen in the last 50 years, as far as I can see. And 5% of the population of that first city, Porto Alegre, showed up to participate in writing the city budget. that was 50,000 people, actually. That's 5% of the adult population. And so what, it lasted, it's still in effect, and it had great, you know, as far as revolution is concerned, we have 500 cities in Latin America that have participatory budgeting now, functioning. There are some major ones that don't, but in any event, it had a huge effect. The elite, the corporate powers are trying to suppress that, and they succeeded because of corruption in the party, the Workers' Party, which had this on its platform to start with and which fostered it. And so, you know, you're right about the movement being absolutely necessary. There was a Workers' Party movement that was going on for, I don't know, maybe 20 years under the dictatorship in Brazil. And part of their idea was to have the people make the budgets of the city and even of the state of Rio Grande do Sul, the whole state. Like they had 200,000 people directly participating in making the budget of that state. That's amazing.
Yes.
And I think maybe it took, I'm just guessing now, maybe it took about 5% of the people of Porto Alegre or of the state to corrupt the process enough so that the voters drove the Workers' Party out. So it's another 5%, I'm guessing. There's one more thing I want to say that's related to this. Chuck Turner is in prison, unjustly in prison, way out there in West Virginia. It makes it difficult for any of us to visit him, but some of us are going to visit him anyway. He wrote about an economic bill of rights. And so he took the Constitution, the way you did, more or less, and he looked at that preamble, and every phrase, he showed how it was a reflection of elite power. That he said, you know, in parentheses, "We the people," meant "we the white male property people." It's a very interesting thing to read. You can see it on his website. He did not give a laundry list of economic rights that people ought to have. Instead, what he said is that everybody in Boston, everybody in Springfield or Pittsfield or the state of Massachusetts or the state of Rhode Island, should get together and develop their own economic bill of rights to suit their situation. He never, in his suggestions for an economic bill of rights, what he said was, this has to be developed in like 50 different places, or many, many different places, and that we should come together after we get these things together and talk about how we're going to operate it. He didn't say we need a single U.S. Constitution to come out of these things. He said we need to negotiate how we're going to reconcile the different constitutions insofar as we need to for trade and so forth. It's a very instructive kind of thing. And you can read about it in the BCA Dispatch on the last page. I sort of summarized what he was saying.
Well, thank you for that. So I just, not a question, but an important comment. So everybody knows I support Chuck Turner, and I think it's an example of what the elites do whenever you know, our leaders actually come forward up and out of the movement. And David Cobb is very proud to say, "Free Chuck Turner." And I'm glad to hear that people are actually going to visit him. Because moving him to West Virginia is just another example of how the racist system actually operates to try to prevent his family and friends and loved ones to be able to visit him. And I'm proud that Chuck Turner is standing strong against the state. Did everybody have a chance to sign?
No, I didn't.
All right. So who's number four?
Where's
yes.
that hat?
John. Yeah, and I will do the same in my response. Number four. Yes, sir. Ma'am, sorry. You're the... I'm so glad, ma'am, that you actually bring that up because, you know, Jefferson, it's worth pointing out, by the way, that the Constitution was, if you didn't know this, she's right. Jefferson was in France when the Constitutional Convention happened. The convention, in fact, of 1787 was a runaway convention, and they weren't actually supposed to rewrite the whole document. In addition to that, when Jefferson got back after the convention, there was no doubt that it was not going to pass because Jefferson was opposed to it. And in fact, the only way that Jefferson was willing to do it is if a set of amendments got passed along with it. Of course, we now think of those as what?
The
Bill of Rights. And of course, Jefferson...
He wanted 11.
He actually wanted 12. He wanted 12. Jefferson actually demanded 12 Bill of Rights. The first one, do you know?
No corporate monopolies ever to be involved in our government.
Literally, Jefferson's 11th Amendment, if it had passed, the prohibition against corporatist monopolies. And there was a second one. Check this out. He wanted an actual provision within the structural form of government that would forbid the creation of a standing army.
That's right.
What?
That's right.
I'm telling you. Like, can we even begin to imagine? Now, Jefferson was a slave owner. We've got to tell that truth. But we also got to understand that the difference between such a governing structure that had just those individual Bill of Rights that also included a structural prohibition against the monopolies of joint stock companies as monopolies or a standing army. Yes, you could. Obviously, Jefferson had been all for raising a Continental Army to kick out the British Empire, but he said there should never be a standing army. It should only be state militias, individual states, or anytime there needed to be, if there was ever a need for a national defense, then you raise the army at that time and only then. So, good point. Number five. Yes, sir.
You were much more committed to the Constitutional Convention. But I'm wondering a little bit how the Lutheran event differs from free speech for people and other such organizations which are pursuing somewhat similar objectives.
Yes. I'm happy to tell. So there are basically, right now, if you go to the website United for the People, you will see, I think it's four, right? The people. If you go to this website, you'll see a number of different organizations, all of which are saying we need a constitutional amendment. I want to actually point out how awesome that is, that you actually have a constellation of movements and groups that actually are calling for a constitutional amendment. Here is my best, most respectful way to show the similarities and differences. Move to Amend says abolish corporate personhood. Corporations do not have any inherent constitutional rights. And plus money is not speech. All right, so that's where Move to Amend says. Free speech for people says abolish corporate personhood, but they're silent that money is not speech. In fact, do you see the difference there? All right. Then People for the American Way and Public Citizen are basically saying we think there needs to be a constitutional amendment to address Citizens United, but we're not actually taking a position one way or another. Mostly, they're going to be about money not being speech, though, because that's where they come out of. But they haven't even taken a position yet. And then lastly, and I got to give a big shout out to Common Cause, because Common Cause, at the national level, is the only national organization that has said, really, there seems to be two things at play, whether corporations have constitutional rights and money is not speech. At the national level, says Common Cause, we're going to defer to whatever our state chapter wants to do, which I think is such an empowering approach for a national chapter-based organization. So if any of you are members of Common Cause, I want to let y'all know that Move to Amend is already partnering with Common Cause in Colorado to actually, and are in partnership. And if anybody is participatory in Common Cause, I want to let you know that I sent an email to their recording secretary who, if he wants to acknowledge himself, happens to be in this room. If not, that's okay. I don't want to out anybody. But there he is. Dave England, right there, is the secretary for Common Cause. Thank you for that today. And I sent it to Pam Wellman, who is your executive director. So we are trying to engage them. And that is my best and most honest way to answer the differences in the approaches, or at least what the calls in the Constitutional Convention, Constitutional Amendment that we're calling for. We think that you have to abolish corporate personhood and a provision that's clear and explicit, money is not speech. Because even if you abolish corporate personhood, that'll get corporate money out of elections, and it'll also prevent them from being able to overturn environmental protection laws, worker safety laws, public health laws, and it would still allow the Buckley versus Vallejo and First National Bank versus Bilotti to be standing law. So we think you have to do both. Some people think, no, it's too hard, just abolish corporate personhood, don't mess with money as speech. Others say, no, just address money is not speech. We think, in the spirit of what, like if we're going to amend the Constitution, can we actually be what we're for? Can we at least say we're going to be for what we're for? This is what we're for at Move to Amend, and we're not making a strategic, like, ooh, we don't want to actually ask what we're for because we might piss off the Tea Party. So, and here's the other thing, and I say this with humility. I'll just talk about Move to Amend. We have a clear and unambiguous commitment to anti-oppression, anti-racism, anti-sexism, and we build it into everything that we do. It's part of the reason that we're multiracial and multi-ethnic. It's part of the reason that the leadership of the Move to Amend Coalition actually comes out of grassroots groups from across the country. And so I'm actually saying I totally respect that there are people with differences of opinions about how to proceed. I respect that. I can work in parallel with them on some things, but for my money, they are not going deep enough, they're not going far enough, and I want the whole thing. Number five, sir. Number six. Yes, ma'am.
This may be a naive question, but is it such a good thing as a good corporation?
Absolutely, there's such a thing as a good corporation. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry?
We're in one.
That's right. Yes. Well, Move to Amend is a nonprofit corporation. Likewise, there are good for-profit business corporations. Most of them, though, are smaller. You know, the thing is, I want to be clear. I'm not anti-government. I'm not anti-business. I believe in appropriate government. I believe in appropriate business. I believe in appropriate corporations. See, the reality is that a small or mid-sized corporation never claims their constitutional rights. Like, this ridiculous idea that a corporation gets to be a person with constitutional rights, only ExxonMobil and Walmart and BP, BP and, these huge transnational corporations ever claim that legal doctrine. So here's the point. I said it before, I'm not anti-corporation, and I want to do it this way. Imagine, if you will, a hot summer day in Boston. I've been here in the summer. That should not be hard. Right? Okay, are y'all with me? Hot summer day? Now imagine that Ethan comes over and sees me on this hot summer day, and I'm cutting a tomato. And Ethan says, David, what are you doing? And I say, actually, I'm preparing a gazpacho soup. I grew these tomatoes myself. They're fresh, they're organic, and the recipe is delightful. You're going to really enjoy it. Here's a question. Is that knife good or bad? Well, it's good, right? I'm putting it to good use. I'm going to share my soup with Ethan. Now, imagine the same scenario. It's a hot summer day in Boston. Ethan comes to me and says, David, what are you doing? And I say, yeah! And I come to David and Ethan with the knife. And now the question is the knife good or bad? Say it again. The knife is neutral. The knife is an instrument. The problem is not with the knife. The problem is with David Cobb. In scenario number one, you have good and kind David Cobb. Generous David Cobb. Sharing David Cobb. Good David Cobb. Let's encourage that behavior. In the second scenario, you have bad David Cobb.
Psycho.
You have psycho David Cobb. Defective David Cobb. Let me tell you something. If I come rushing at Ethan with a knife, I hope Ethan's first reaction is to block the knife. Block the knife, Ethan. All right, so now let me ask you something. Is Ethan's problem solved?
Right.
See, here's the thing, sister. I think that we make a mistake if we only focus on the corporation and whether the corporation is good or bad. A corporation is an instrument. It's a human construct that we can create. The problem, in my estimation, is that today we have enshrined and protected this instrument, and we allow the instrument to do unjust things and legalize the horrific things that they do. And isn't it kind of crazy? I mean, full-on insane to say, this knife now will get to become so powerful that we will say it, as an instrument, has constitutional rights.
That's crazy.
So do you see my point? So I could name off good corporations, and I say this with much love in my heart, I think it would be a mistake to do that. Now, as an individual, I try to only shop at corporations and business entities that I know have fair business practices, that don't destroy the environment. I do that as an individual because it's the right thing to do. I do not pretend for a moment that my individual action will actually impact. However, collectively, if we engage in a boycott, that will work. And even deeper, if collectively we decide to create new models of business, worker cooperatives, worker-owned cooperatives, if we start to engage in participatory budgeting, not just at the municipal level, but in our own organizations, if we actually learn how to share power and actually experience democracy, that's the sweet spot. Number seven? Yes, you were seven. Yes. No, that's okay.
But the other one was what we're talking about with corporations in the way that they were similar to what you hear about broadcasters. In other words, that like if you have a television station or a radio station, a certain portion of your programming has to be to the good of the public.
That used to be the case.
Okay, and sometimes you still hear. I know that before it was mandatory. How did that continue into radio or television during the 20th century, yet get lost for our corporations?
All right, so how do they get lost? There's a couple of things at play here. Number one, I want to focus first and foremost on the media itself, because the public trust doctrine in the media is actually gone now. And you'll notice I was very clear about not getting partisan, but now I have to answer this question. It's because of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party destroyed and gutted the existence of Fox News can be directly linked to the destruction of the creation of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, right, under Bill Clinton. Just like NAFTA, just like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we can go through all of the litany of problems. So that's the modern problem with broadcasting.
And the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine.
Oh, the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine. Yeah, that's right.
Abolition what?
Boom.
Fairness.
You're broke. That's right. The fairness doctrine was also destroyed, eliminated by Bill Clinton.
It was underrated, but it happened.
No, it actually started under that, but you're right. The
fairness doctrine really is bigger.
And that happened under Reagan. And so that's right. I'm an equal opportunity jeerer of the ruling elites, regardless of what party they're from. So it was both of them. Now, back to the other question. How is it true that at least the idea of the public trust was able to be maintained for print and radio? Because it wasn't print. It was only radio and television. Because radio and television used the public airwaves. And there was still an idea that because it was the public airwaves, that the licensing requirement to be able to have the monopoly was that it served the public good. Do you know what we get into our public treasury in order to allow those monopolies?
Zero.
So here's the thing, y'all. I mean, again, it's another example. We could have a different world. Like the idea of recreating not only the public trust doctrine, but also the idea of preventing monopolies within media, that's possible if we only have the political will. So it's not magic. It's fortitude. It's self-respect. Number 8. Yes, sir.
I went a long time back to board the ACLU, and I would call to learn now that they had an amicus on behalf of citizens of the United States. Could you explain what they're doing?
Okay, so there's two. Yeah, I get
stonewalled
too.
Brief,
be very brief. There are two potential reasons the ACLU might have supported Citizens United. The first one, it might be because they believe that free speech is so sacrosanct that it can never be infringed upon by any way. I think that that's a wrong interpretation. It misunderstands the equal protection clause. The second reason is the more cynical one. It may be the more correct one because they get $50 million from Philip Morris Corporation. That might be the other reason. I'll leave it to you to decide. Jill, you got the last comment. All right, so here and here. Jill Stein.
Yeah, real quick. You know, there's nothing that drives us to the realm of new possibilities like the incredible crises that we're facing that you began with. So it really changes what we can do going forward. And, you know, given the pervasive wipeout that people are facing on jobs and their homes and their schools and the potential to go to school and the environment and the future, the climate, you know, things are very fluid politically and movement-wise. You know, the occupation on Wall Street taking place now, you know, to the murder of Troy Davis and the incredible wake-up call that's been to our criminal justice system and to the movement to fight that. There's just all kinds of turmoil that can create some really great things now. And as was being alluded to earlier, we have two parties that are funded by, you know, by corporate money and are essentially converging on their agendas across the board, from healthcare to jobs and Wall Street bailouts and wars and you name it. They basically converge. At the same time, there is a whole new realm of possibility opening up now for non-corporate third parties, of which there is essentially one right now, which is the Green Party or the Green Rainbow Party here. And I just want to mention one race that's going on right now, because in this effort to build a movement, you really want to look for critical breakthrough points, and this is one of those absolutely mind-boggling critical breakthrough points. And I just want everybody to know about it, because I have changed my personal schedule for the next 3 weeks so that I can go out to Berkshire County as a Pittsfield to help Mark Miller get elected, who is a Green Rainbow candidate for legislature in a special election. He got 45% of the vote in the last race. The guy he ran against basically quit, like the three other Democrats before him, who all quit their position in order to become a lobbyist, Pittsfield, in order to become lobbyists or to get patronage jobs, basically. So there's been such a wake-up call in Pittsfield. He now has the endorsements of the Progressive Democrats. Even though there's a Democrat in the race, he's endorsed by the Progressive Democrats, the Young Democrats, the Social Democrats, The labor unions, for the first time, have crossed over and endorsed him. The Mass Alliance, which is this broad collection of sort of liberal groups that normally wouldn't touch a green with a 10-foot pole, they are endorsing him. What we basically need now are troops on the ground over the next 3 weeks. I'm going out on Saturdays. I have a car that has a few places left in it. I think Dave England has some days he's going out. We're looking for more people to just come help, because if we can break through here, it will basically open the floodgates in a completely unprecedented way, not only to what we can do in the legislature in Massachusetts, but to getting non-corporate green candidates elected really all over the nation. We can point to this as a breakthrough and really build on it.
Thank you so much. We gotta go, y'all. Very quick.
Okay.
Seconds.
The general welfare clause that you mentioned in the Article 1 talks about the general welfare of the United States, not the people of the United States. In the preamble, if the sense is promoting the general welfare, I've always taken it for the people. So what is the power of the preamble? Does it have a power? And is this true that it's just the welfare of this entity, the United States, and not the people of the United States? And how does it work?
Well, in a nutshell, it would be like, there is, saying the United States is a construct, it's the people of the United States, there's case law that actually says that. And the preamble has never been used. So we got to go, John. This is all we got to say. John,
please stand.